flexible arm as arm standard. Assumption that both arms are approximately the same length. Step 2. Calculate angle of bend at elbow. Step 3. Calculate curvature of ass. Approximation of this may be necessary in absence of verifiable numbers. Step 4. Calculate size of hand using visible hand as above. "I'm not a numbers person," said Jimmy, laughing, but Craik kept on. "All potential hand positions must now be considered. Waist ruled out. Upper right cheek ruled out. Lower right cheek or upper thigh would seem by deduction to be the most likely. Hand between both upper thighs a possibility, but this position would impede walking on the part of the subject, and no limping or stumbling is detectable." He was doing a pretty good imitation of their chem lab teacher, the "use your neurons" line, and that clipped, stiff delivery, sort of like a bark. More than pretty good. Good. Already Jimmy liked Craik better. They might have something in common after all. At least the guy had a sense of humor. But he was also a little threatened. He himself was a good imitator. He could do just about all the teachers. What if Craik turned out to be better at it? He could feel it within himself to hate Craik, as well as liking him. But in the days that followed, Craik gave no public performances. Craik had had a thing about him even then, thinks Snowman. Not that he was popular exactly, but people felt flattered by his regard. Not just the kids, the teachers too. He'd look at them as if he was listening, as if what they were talking about was worthy of his full attention, though he would never say so exactly. He generated awe, not an overwhelming amount of it, but enough. He exuded potential, but potential for what? Nobody knew, and so people were wary of him. All of this in his dark, laconic clothing. Brain frizz. Wakulla Price had been Jimmy's lab partner in nanotech biochem, but her father was headhunted by a compound on the other side of the continent, and she'd taken the high-speed sealed bullet train and was never seen again. After she'd gone, Jimmy moped for a week, and not even Linda Lee's dirty-mouthed convulsions could console him. Wakulla's vacant place at the lab table was filled by Craik, who was moved up from his solitary latecomer's position at the back of the room. Craik was very smart, even in the world of Healthwiser High, with its overstock of borderline geniuses and polymaths. He had no trouble floating at the top of the list. He turned out to be excellent at nanotech biochem, and together he and Jimmy worked on their single molecular layer splicing project, managing to produce the required purple nematode using the color coder from a primitive seaweed before schedule and with no alarming variations. Jimmy and Craik took to hanging out together at lunch hour, and then, not every day, they weren't gay or anything, but at least twice a week, after school. At first they'd played tennis on the clay court behind Craik's place, but Craik combined method with lateral thinking and hated to lose, and Jimmy was impetuous and lacked finesse, so that wasn't too productive, and they dropped it. Or, under pretense of doing their homework, which sometimes they really would do, they would shut themselves up in Craik's room, where they would play computer chess, or three dimensionals, or QuickTime Osama, tossing to see who got infidels. Craik had two computers, so they could sit with their backs to each other, one at each. "Why don't we use a real set?" Jimmy asked one day when they were doing some chess. "The old kind, with plastic men." It did seem weird to have the two of them in the same room, back to back, playing on computers. "Why?" said Craik. "Anyway, this is a real set." "No, it's not." "Okay, granted, but neither is plastic men." "What?" "The real set is in your head."
"Bogus!" Jimmy yelled.
It was a good word. He'd got it off an old DVD. They'd taken to using it to tear each other down for being pompous.
"Way too bogus!"
Craik laughed. Craik would get fixated on a game, and would want to play it, and play it, and perfect his attack until he was sure he could win, 9 times out of 10 anyway. For a whole month they'd had to play Barbarian Stomp,
"See if you can change history."
One side had the cities and the riches, and the other side had the hordes, and usually, but not always, the most viciousness. Either the barbarians stomped the cities, or else they got stomped, but you had to start out with the historical disposition of energies and go on from there. Rome versus the Visigoths, ancient Egypt versus the Hyksos, Aztecs versus the Spaniards. That was a cute one, because it was the Aztecs who represented civilization, while the Spaniards were the barbarian hordes. You could customize the game, as long as you used real societies and tribes, and for a while Craik and Jimmy vied with each other to see who could come up with the most obscure pairing. "Pecheneggs versus Byzantium," said Jimmy one memorable day.
"Who the fuck are the Pecheneggs? You made that up," said Craik.
But Jimmy had found it in the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1957 edition, which was stored on CD-ROM for some forgotten reason in the school library. He had chapter and verse. "Matthew of Edessa referred to them as wicked, blood-drinking beasts," he was able to say with authority. "They were totally ruthless and had no redeeming features." So they tossed for sides, and Jimmy got Pecheneggs and won. The Byzantines were slaughtered, because that was what Pecheneggs did, Jimmy explained. They always slaughtered everyone immediately. Or they slaughtered the men, at least. Then they slaughtered the women after a while. Craik took the loss of all of his players badly, and sulked a little. After that he'd switched his loyalty to Blood and Roses. It was more cosmic, said Craik. The field of battle was larger, both in time and space. Blood and Roses was a trading game along the lines of Monopoly. The blood side played with human atrocities for the counters, atrocities on a large scale. Individual rapes and murders didn't count. There had to have been a large number of people wiped out. Massacres, genocides, that sort of thing. The Roses side played with human achievements. Artworks, scientific breakthroughs, stellar works of architecture, helpful inventions. Monuments to the soul's magnificence, they were called in the game. There were sidebar buttons, so that if you didn't know what Crime and Punishment was, or the Theory of Relativity, or the Trail of Tears, or Madame Bovary, or the Hundred Years' War, or the Flight into Egypt, you could double-click and get an illustrated rundown in two choices, R for children, P-O-N for profanity, obscenity, and nudity. That was the thing about history, said Craik. It had lots of all three. You rolled the virtual dice, and either a rose or a blood item would pop up. If it was a blood item, the rose player had a chance to stop the atrocity from happening, but he had to put up a rose item in exchange. The atrocity would then vanish from history, or at least the history recorded on the screen. The blood player could acquire a rose item, but only by handing over an atrocity, thus leaving himself with less ammunition and the rose player with more. If he was a skillful player, he could attack the rose side by means of the atrocities in his possession, loot the human achievement, and transfer it to his side of the board. The player who managed to retain the most human achievements by time's up was the winner, with points off, naturally, for achievements destroyed through his own error and folly and cretinous play. The exchange rates, one Mona Lisa equaled Bergen-Belsen, one Armenian genocide equaled the Ninth Symphony plus three Great Pyramids, were suggested, but there was room for haggling. To do this, you needed to know the numbers. The total number of corpses for the atrocities, the latest open market price for the artworks, or if the artworks had been stolen, the amount paid out by the insurance policy. It was a wicked game. "Homer," says Snowman, making his way through the dripping wet vegetation. "The Divine Comedy. Greek statuary, aqueducts. Paradise Lost, Mozart's music, Shakespeare complete works, the Brontes, Tolstoy, the Pearl Mosque, Chartres Cathedral, Bach, Rembrandt, Verdi, Joyce, Penicillin, Keats, Turner, heart transplants, polio vaccine, Berlioz, Baudelaire, Bartok, Yeats, Wolfe." There must have been more. There were more. "The Sack of Troy," says a voice in his ear. "The destruction of Carthage. The Vikings. The Crusades. Genghis Khan. Attila the Hun. The massacre of the Cathars. The witch burnings. The destruction of the Aztec. Ditto the Maya. Ditto the Inca. The Inquisition. Vlad the Impaler. The massacre of the Huguenots. Cromwell in Ireland. The French Revolution. The Napoleonic Wars. The Irish Famine. Slavery in the American South. King Leopold in the Congo. The Russian Revolution. Stalin. Hitler. Hiroshima. Mao. Pol Pot. Idi Amin. Sri Lanka. East Timor. Saddam Hussein. Stop it, says Snowman.
Sorry, honey. Only trying to help.
That was the trouble with Blood and Roses. It was easier to remember the blood stuff. The other trouble was that the blood player usually won, but winning meant you inherited a wasteland. This was the point of the game, said Craik, when Jimmy complained. Jimmy said if that was the point, it was pretty pointless. He didn't want to tell Craik that he was having some severe nightmares. The one where the Parthenon was decorated with cut-off heads was, for some reason, the worst. By unspoken consent, they'd given up on Blood and Roses, which was fine with Craik because he was into something new. Extinctathon, an interactive biofreak master lore game he'd found on the web. Extinctathon, monitored by Mad Adam. Adam named the living animals, Mad Adam names the dead ones. Do you want to play? That was what came up when you logged on. You then had to click yes, enter your code name, and pick one of the two chat rooms, Kingdom Animal, Kingdom Vegetable. Then some challenger would come online using his own code name, Komodo, Rhino, Manatee, Hippocampus Ramulosus, and propose a contest. Begins with, number of legs, what is it? The it would be some bioform that had cacked out within the past 50 years. No T-Rex, no rock, no dodo, and points off for getting the time frame wrong. Then you'd narrow it down, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, then the habitat and when last seen, and what had snuffed it. Pollution, habitat destruction, credulous morons who thought that eating its horn would give them a boner. The longer the challenger held out, the more points he got, but you could win big bonuses for speed. It helped to have the Mad Adam printout of every extinct species, but that gave you only the Latin names, and anyway it was a couple of hundred pages of fine print and filled with obscure bugs, weeds, and frogs nobody had ever heard of. Nobody, except, it seemed, the Extinctathon Grandmasters, who had brains like search engines. You always knew when you were playing one of those, because a little coelacanth symbol would come up on the screen. Coelacanth. Prehistoric deep-sea fish, long supposed extinct, until specimens found in mid-20th. Present status unknown. Extinctathon was nothing if not informative. It was like some tedious pedant you got trapped beside on the school van, in Jimmy's view. It wouldn't shut up. "Why do you like this so much?" said Jimmy one day, to Craik's hunched-over back.
"Because I'm good at it," said Craik.
Jimmy suspected him of wanting to make Grandmaster, not because it meant anything, but just because it was there. Craik had picked their code names. Jimmy's was Thickney, after a defunct Australian double-jointed bird that used to hang around in cemeteries, and, Jimmy suspected, because Craik liked the sound of it, as applied to Jimmy. Craik's code name was Craik, after the red-necked Craik, another Australian bird. Never, said Craik, very numerous. For a while they called each other Craik and Thickney, as an in-joke. After Craik had realized Jimmy was not wholeheartedly participating, and they'd stopped playing Extinctathon, Thickney as a name had faded away. But Craik had stuck. When they weren't playing games, they'd surf the net, drop in on old favorites, see what was new. They'd watch open-heart surgery in live time, or else the nudie news, which was good for a few minutes because the people on it tried to pretend there was nothing unusual going on, and studiously avoided looking at one another's jujubes. Or they'd watch animal snuff sites, Felicia's frog squash and the like, though these quickly grew repetitious. One stomped frog, one cat being torn apart by hand was much like another. Or they'd watch DirtySockPuppets.com, a current affairs show about world political leaders. Craik said that with digital gen alteration you couldn't tell whether any of these generals and whatnot existed anymore, and if they did, whether they'd actually said what you'd heard. Anyway, they were toppled and replaced with such rapidity that it hardly mattered. Or they might watch HeadsOff.com, which played live coverage of executions in Asia. There they could see enemies of the people being topped with swords in some place that looked like China, while thousands of spectators cheered. Or they could watch Alibubu.com, with various supposed thieves having their hands cut off and adulterers and lipstick wearers being stoned to death by howling crowds in dusty enclaves that purported to be in fundamentalist countries in the Middle East. The coverage was usually poor on that site. Filming was said to be prohibited, so it was just some desperate pauper with a hidden mini-video cam risking his life for filthy Western currency. You saw mostly the backs and heads of the spectators, so it was like being trapped inside a huge clothes rack until the guy with the camera got caught, and then there would be a flurry of hands and cloth before the picture went black. Craik said these bloodfests were probably taking place on a back lot somewhere in California, with a bunch of extras rounded up off the streets. Better than these were the American sites, with their sports event commentary. Here he comes now, yes, it's Joe the Ratchet Set Ricardo, voted tops by you viewers. Then a rundown of the crimes, with grisly pictures of the victims. These sites would have spot commercials for things like car batteries and tranquilizers, and logos painted in bright yellow on the background walls. At least the Americans put some style into it, said Craik. ShortCircuit.com, BrainFrizz.com, and DeathRowLive.com were the best. They showed electrocutions and lethal injections. Once they'd made real-time coverage legal, the guys being executed had started hamming it up for the cameras. They were mostly guys with the occasional woman, but Jimmy didn't like to watch those. A woman being croaked was a solemn, weepy affair, and people tended to stand around with lighted candles and pictures of the kids, or show up with poems they'd written themselves. But the guys could be a riot. You could watch them making faces, giving the guards the finger, cracking jokes, and occasionally breaking free, and being chased around the room, trailing restraint straps and shouting foul abuse. Craik said these incidents were bogus. He said the men were paid to do it, or their families were. The sponsors required them to put on a good show because otherwise people would get bored and turn off. The viewers wanted to see the executions, yes, but after a while these could get monotonous, so one last fighting chance had to be added in, or else an element of surprise. 2-1, it was all rehearsed. Jimmy said this was an awesome theory. Awesome was another old word, like bogus, that he'd dredged out of the DVD archives. Do you think they're really being executed? He said. A lot of them look like simulations. You never know, said Craik. You never know what. What is reality? Bogus. There was an assisted suicide site, too, NightyNight.com, it was called, which had a This Was Your Life component. Family albums, interviews with relatives, brave parties of friends standing by while the deed was taking place to background organ music. After the sad-eyed doctor had declared that life was extinct, there were taped testimonials from the participants themselves, stating why they'd chosen to depart. The assisted suicide statistics shot way up after this show got going. There was said to be a long lineup of people waiting to pay big bucks for a chance to appear on it and snuff themselves in glory, and lotteries were held to choose the participants. Craik grinned a lot while watching this site. For some reason he found it hilarious, whereas Jimmy did not. He couldn't imagine doing such a thing himself, unlike Craik, who said it showed flair to know when you'd had enough. But did Jimmy's reluctance mean he was a coward? Or was it just that the organ music sucked? These planned departures made him uneasy. They reminded him of Alex the parrot saying, "I'm going away now." There was too fine a line between Alex the parrot and the assisted suicides and his mother and the note she'd left for him. All three gave notice of their intentions, then all vanished. Or they would watch At Home with Anna Kay. Anna Kay was a self-styled installation artist with big boobs who'd wired up her apartment so that every moment of her life was sent out live to millions of voyeurs. "This is Anna Kay, thinking always about my happiness and my unhappiness," was what you'd get as you joined her. Then you might watch her tweezing her eyebrows, waxing her bikini line, washing her underwear. Sometimes she'd read scenes from old plays out loud, taking all the parts, while sitting on the can with her retro-look bell-bottom jeans around her ankles. This was how Jimmy first encountered Shakespeare, through Anna Kay's rendition of Macbeth. "Tomorrow, and tomorrow and tomorrow, creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Read Anna Kay. She was a terrible ham, but Snowman has always been grateful to her, because she'd been a doorway of sorts. Think what he might not have known if it hadn't been for her. Think of the words. Seer, for instance. Incarnadine. What is this shit? Said Craig. Channel change! No, wait, wait, said Jimmy, who had been seized by, what? Something he wanted to hear. And Craig waited, because he did humor Jimmy sometimes. Or they would watch the Queek Geek Show, which had contests featuring the eating of live animals and birds, timed by stopwatches, with prizes of hard-to-come-by foods. It was amazing what people would do for a couple of lamb chops or a chunk of genuine brie. Or they would watch porn shows. There were a lot of those. When did the body first set out on its own adventures, Snowman thinks, after having ditched its old traveling companions, the mind and the soul, for whom it had once been considered a mere corrupt vessel, or else a puppet acting out their dramas for them, or else bad company, leading the other two astray? It must have got tired of the soul's constant nagging and whining, and the anxiety-driven intellectual web-spinning of the mind, distracting it whenever it was getting its teeth into something juicy, or its fingers into something good. It had dumped the other two back there somewhere, leaving them stranded in some damp sanctuary or stuffy lecture hall while it made a beeline for the topless bars, and it had dumped culture along with them, music and painting, and poetry and plays, sublimation all of it. Nothing but sublimation, according to the body. Why not cut to the chase? But the body had its own cultural forms. It had its own art. Executions were its tragedies. Pornography was its romance. To access the more disgusting and forbidden sites, those for which you had to be over 18 and for which you needed a special password, Craig used his Uncle Pete's private code, via a complicated method he called a lily pad labyrinth. He'd construct a winding pathway through the web, hacking in at random through some easy-access commercial enterprise, then skipping from lily pad to lily pad, erasing his footprints as he went. That way, when Uncle Pete got the bill, he couldn't find out who'd run it up. Craig had also located Uncle Pete's stash of high-grade Vancouver skunkweed, kept in orange juice cans in the freezer. He'd take out about a quarter of the can, then mix in some of the low-octane carpet sweepings you could buy at the school tuck shop for $50 a baggie. He said Uncle Pete would never know because he never smoked except when he wanted to have sex with Craig's mother, which, judging from the number of orange juice cans and the rate at which they were getting used up, wasn't often. Craig said Uncle Pete got his real kicks at the office, bossing people around, whipping the wage slaves. He used to be a scientist, but now he was a large managerial ultra-cheese at Healthwiser, on the financial end of things. So they'd roll a few joints and smoke them while watching the executions and the porn, the body parts moving around on the screen in slow motion, an underwater ballet of flesh and blood under stress, hard and soft joining and separating, groans and screams, close-ups of clenched eyes and clenched teeth, spurts of this or that. If you switched back and forth fast, it all came to look like the same event. Sometimes they'd have both things on at once, each on a different screen. These sessions would take place for the most part in silence, except for the sound effects coming from the machines. It would be Craig who'd decide what to watch and when to stop watching it. Fair enough, they were his computers. He might say, "Finished with that?" before changing. He didn't seem to be affected by anything he saw, one way or the other, except when he thought it was funny. He never seemed to get high, either. Jimmy suspected he didn't really inhale. Jimmy, on the other hand, would wobble homewards, still fuzzy from the dope and feeling as if he'd been to an orgy, one at which he'd had no control at all over what had happened to him, what had been done to him. He also felt very light, as if he were made of air, thin, dizzying air at the top of some garbage-strewn Mount Everest. Back at home base, his parental units, supposing they were there and downstairs, never seemed to notice a thing. "Getting enough to eat?" Ramona might say to him. She'd interpret his mumble as a yes. Hot Tots. Late afternoons were the best time for doing these things at Craig's place. Nobody interrupted them. Craig's mother was out a lot, or in a hurry. She worked as a diagnostician at the hospital complex. She was an intense, square-jawed, dark-haired woman with not much of a chest. On the rare occasions when Jimmy had been there at the same time as Craig's mother, she hadn't said much. She'd dug around in the kitchen cupboards for something that would pass as a snack for you boys, as she called the two of them. Sometimes she would stop in the middle of her preparations, the dumping of stale crackers onto a plate, the sawing up of chewy orange and white marbled hunks of cheese food, and stand stock still, as if she could see someone else in the room. Jimmy had the impression she couldn't remember his name. Not only that, she couldn't remember Craig's name either. Sometimes she would ask Craig if his room was tidy, though she never went in there herself. "She believes in respecting a child's privacy," said Craig, straight-faced. "I bet it's your moldy socks," said Jimmy. "All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten these little socks." He'd recently discovered the joys of quotation. "For that, we've got room spray," said Craig. As for Uncle Pete, he was rarely home before 7. Healthweiser was expanding like helium, and therefore he had a lot of new responsibilities. He wasn't Craig's real uncle, he was just Craig's mother's second husband. He'd taken on that status when Craig had been 12, a couple of years too old for the uncle tag to have been viewed by him as anything but totally rancid. Yet Craig had accepted the status quo, or so it appeared. He'd smile, he'd say, "Sure, Uncle Pete," and "That's right, Uncle Pete," when the man was around, even though Jimmy knew Craig disliked him. One afternoon in, what, March it must have been, because it was already hot as hell outside, the two of them were watching porn in Craig's room. Already it felt like old time's sake, already it felt like nostalgia, something they were too grown up for, like middle-aged guys cruising the plebland teeny clubs. Still, they dutifully lit up a joint, hacked into Uncle Pete's digital charge card via a new labyrinth, and started surfing. They checked into Tart of the Day, which featured elaborate confectionery in the usual orifices, then went to Super Swallowers, then to a Russian site that employed ex-acrobats, ballerinas, and contortionists. "Whoever said a guy can't suck his own," was Craig's comment. The high-wire act with the 6 flaming torches was pretty good, but they'd seen things like that before. Then they went to Hot Tots, a global sex-trotting site. The next best thing to being there was how it was advertised. It claimed to show real sex tourists, filmed while doing things they'd be put in jail for back in their home countries. Their faces weren't visible, their names weren't used, but the possibilities for blackmail, Snowman realizes now, must have been extensive. The locations were supposed to be countries where life was cheap, and kids were plentiful, and where you could buy anything you wanted. This was how the two of them first saw Oryx. She was only about 8, or she looked 8. They could never find out for certain how old she'd been then. Her name wasn't Oryx, she didn't have a name. She was just another little girl on a porno site. None of those little girls had ever seemed real to Jimmy. They'd always struck him as digital clones, but for some reason Oryx was 3-dimensional from the start. She was small-boned and exquisite, and naked like the rest of them, with nothing on her but a garland of flowers and a pink hair ribbon, frequent props on the sex kitty sites. She was on her knees, with another little girl on either side of her, positioned in front of the standard gargantuan Gulliver in Lilliput male torso, a life-sized man shipwrecked on an island of delicious midgets, or stolen away and entranced, forced to experience agonizing pleasures by a trio of soulless pixies. The guy's distinguishing features were concealed. Bag with eye holes over the head, surgical tape over the tattoos and scars. Few of these types wanted to be spotted by the folks back home, though the possibility of detection must have been part of the thrill. The act involved whipped cream and a lot of licking. The effect was both innocent and obscene. The three of them were going over the guy with their kittenish tongues and their tiny fingers, giving him a thorough workout to the sound of moans and giggles. The giggles must have been recorded, because they weren't coming from the three girls. They all looked frightened, and one of them was crying. Jimmy knew the drill. They were supposed to look like that, he thought. If they stopped the action, a walking stick would come in from offside and prod them. This was a feature of the site. There were at least three layers of contradictory make-believe, one on top of the other. I want to, I want to not, I want to. Oryx paused in her activities. She smiled a hard little smile that made her appear much older, and wiped the whipped cream from her mouth. Then she looked over her shoulder, and right into the eyes of the viewer, right into Jimmy's eyes, into the secret person inside him. I see you, that look said. I see you watching. I know you. I know what you want. Craik pushed the reverse, then the freeze, then the download. Every so often he froze frames. By now he had a small archive of them. Sometimes he'd print them out and give a copy to Jimmy. It could be dangerous. It could leave a footprint for anyone who might manage to trace a way through the labyrinth, but Craik did it anyway. So now he saved that one moment. The moment when Oryx looked. Jimmy felt burned by this look, eaten into, as if by acid. She'd been so contemptuous of him. The joint he'd been smoking must have had nothing in it but lawn mowings. If it had been stronger, he might have been able to bypass guilt. But for the first time, he'd felt that what they'd been doing was wrong. Before, it had always been entertainment, or else far beyond his control, but now he felt culpable. At the same time, he felt hooked through the gills. If he'd been offered instant teleportation to wherever Oryx was, he'd have taken it, no question. He'd have begged to go there. It was all too complicated. "This a keeper?" Craik said. "You want it?" "Yeah," said Jimmy. He could barely get the word out. He hoped he sounded normal. So Craik had printed it, the picture of Oryx looking, and Snowman had saved it and saved it. He'd shown it to Oryx many years later. "I don't think this is me," was what she'd said at first. "It has to be," said Jimmy. "Look, it's your eyes." "A lot of girls have eyes," she said. "A lot of girls did these things. Very many." Then, seeing his disappointment, she said, "It might be me. Maybe it is. Would that make you happy, Jimmy?"
"No," said Jimmy. "Was that a lie?"
"Why did you keep it?"
"What were you thinking?" Snowman said instead of answering. Another woman in her place would have crumpled up the picture, cried, denounced him as a criminal, told him he understood nothing about her life, made a general scene. Instead, she smoothed out the paper, running her fingers gently over the soft, scornful child's face that had surely once been hers.
"You think I was thinking?" she said. "Oh, Jimmy, you always think everyone is thinking." "Maybe I wasn't thinking anything."
"I know you were," he said.
"You want me to pretend? You want me to make something up?"
"No, just tell me."
"Why?"
Jimmy had to think about that. He remembered himself watching. How could he have done that to her? And yet it hadn't hurt her, had it? "Because I need you to." Not much of a reason, but it was all he could come up with. She sighed.
"I was thinking," she said, tracing a little circle on his skin with her fingernail, "that if I ever got the chance, it would not be me down on my knees."
"It would be someone else?" said Jimmy. "Who? What someone?"
"You want to know everything," said Oryx.
5. Toast. Snowman, in his tattered sheet, sits hunched at the edge of the trees, where grass and vetch and sea grapes merge into sand. Now that it's cooler, he feels less dejected. Also, he's hungry. There's something to be said for hunger. At least it lets you know you're still alive. A breeze riffles the leaves overhead. Insects rasp and trill. Red light from the setting sun hits the tower blocks in the water.
illuminating an unbroken pane here and there, as if a scattering of lamps had been turned on. Several of the buildings once held roof gardens, and now they're top-heavy with overgrown shrubbery. Hundreds of birds are streaming across the sky towards them, roostward bound. Ibis? Herons? The black ones are cormorants, he knows that for sure. They settle down into the darkening foliage, croaking and squabbling. If he ever needs guano, he'll know where to find it. Across the clearing to the south comes a rabbit, hopping, listening, pausing to nibble at the grass with its gigantic teeth. It glows in the dusk, a greenish glow filched from the iridocytes of a deep-sea jellyfish in some long-ago experiment. In the half-light, the rabbit looks soft and almost translucent, like a piece of Turkish delight, as if you could suck off its fur like sugar. Even in Snowman's boyhood, there were luminous green rabbits, though they weren't this big, and they hadn't yet slipped their cages and bred with the wild population and become a nuisance. This one has no fear of him, though it fills him with carnivorous desires. He longs to whack it with a rock, tear it apart with his bare hands, then cram it into his mouth, fur and all. But rabbits belong to the children of Oryx, and are sacred to Oryx herself, and it would be a bad idea to offend the women. It's his own fault. He must have been stupefied with drink when he was laying down the laws. He should have made rabbits edible, by himself at any rate, but he can't change that now. He can almost hear Oryx, laughing at him with indulgent, faintly malicious delight. The children of Oryx, the children of Crake. He'd had to think of something. Get your story straight, keep it simple, don't falter. This used to be the expert advice given by lawyers to criminals in the dock. Crake made the bones of the children of Crake out of the coral on the beach, and then he made their flesh out of a mango. But the children of Oryx hatched out of an egg, a giant egg, laid by Oryx herself. Actually, she laid two eggs, one full of animals and birds and fish, and the other one full of words. But the egg full of words hatched first, and the children of Crake had already been created by then, and they'd eaten up all the words because they were hungry. And so there were no words left over when the second egg hatched out. And that is why the animals can't talk. Internal consistency is best. Snowman learned this earlier in his life, when lying had posed more of a challenge for him. Now, even when he's caught in a minor contradiction, he can make it stick, because these people trust him. He's the only one left who'd known Crake face to face, so he can lay claim to the inside track. Above his head flies the invisible banner of Crakedom, of Crakiness, of Crakehood, hallowing all he does. The first star appears. "Starlight, star bright," he says. Some grade school teacher, Big Bum Sally. "Now close your eyes right up tight, tighter, really tight. There, see the wishing star? Now we will all wish for the thing we want the very, very most of all in the whole wide world. But shh, don't tell anyone, or the wish won't come true." Snowman screws his eyes shut, pushes his fists into them, clenches his entire face. "There's the wishing star, all right. It's blue." "I wish I may. I wish I might," he says. "Have the wish I wish tonight." Fat chance.
"Oh, Snowman, why are you talking to no one?" says a voice.
Snowman opens his eyes. Three of the older children are standing just out of reach, regarding him with interest. They must have crept up on him in the dusk.
"I'm talking to Crake," he says.
"But you talk to Crake through your shiny thing. Is it broken?"
Snowman lifts his left arm, holds out his watch.
"This is for listening to Crake. Talking to him is different."
"Why are you talking to him about stars? What are you telling to Crake, O Snowman?"
What indeed, thinks Snowman.
"When dealing with indigenous peoples," says the book in his head, a more modern book this time, late 20th century, the voice a confident female's, "you must attempt to respect their traditions and confine your explanations to simple concepts that can be understood within the contexts of their belief systems.
some earnest aid worker in a khaki jungle outfit with netting under the arms and 100 pockets. Condescending, self-righteous cow, thinks she's got all the answers. He'd known girls like that at college. If she were here, she'd need a whole new take on indigenous.
I was telling him, says Snowman, that you ask too many questions.
He holds his watch to his ear.
And he's telling me that if you don't stop doing that, you'll be toast.
Please, oh Snowman, what is toast?
Another error, Snowman thinks. He should avoid arcane metaphors.
Toast, he says, is something very, very bad. It's so bad I can't even describe it. Now it's your bedtime. Go away.
What is toast? Says Snowman to himself once they've run off.
Toast is when you take a piece of bread.
What is bread?
Bread is when you take some flour.
What is flour? We'll skip that part. It's too complicated. Bread is something you can eat, made from a ground-up plant and shaped like a stone. You cook it.
Please, why do you cook it? Why don't you just eat the plant?
Never mind that part. Pay attention. You cook it, and then you cut it into slices, and you put a slice into a toaster, which is a metal box that heats up with electricity.
What is electricity?
Don't worry about that. While the slice is in the toaster, you get out the butter. Butter is a yellow grease made from the mammary glands of... Skip the butter. So, the toaster turns the slice of bread black on both sides with smoke coming out, and then this toaster shoots the slice up into the air, and it falls onto the floor.
Oh, forget it, says Snowman. Let's try again.
Toast was a pointless invention from the Dark Ages. Toast was an implement of torture that caused all those subjected to it to regurgitate in verbal form the sins and crimes of their past lives. Toast was a ritual item devoured by fetishists in the belief that it would enhance their kinetic and sexual powers. Toast cannot be explained by any rational means. Toast is me. I am toast.
Fish. The sky darkens from ultramarine to indigo. God bless the namers of oil paints and high-class women's underwear, Snowman thinks. Rose petal pink, crimson lake, sheer mist, burnt umber, ripe plum, indigo, ultramarine. They're fantasies in themselves, such words and phrases. It's comforting to remember that Homo sapiens was once so ingenious with language, and not only with language. Ingenious in every direction at once. Monkey brains, had been Craig's opinion. Monkey paws, monkey curiosity, the desire to take apart, turn inside out, smell, fondle, measure, improve, trash, discard, all hooked up to monkey brains. An advanced model of monkey brains, but monkey brains all the same. Craig had no very high opinion of human ingenuity, despite the large amount of it he himself possessed. There's a murmuring of voices from the direction of the village, or from what would be a village if it had any houses. Right on schedule, here come the men, carrying their torches, and behind them, the women. Every time the women appear, Snowman is astonished all over again. They're every known color, from deepest black to whitest white. They're various heights, but each one of them is admirably proportioned. Each is sound of tooth, smooth of skin. No ripples of fat around their waists, no bulges, no dimpled, orange skin cellulite on their thighs, no body hair, no bushiness. They look like retouched fashion photos, or ads for a high-priced workout program. Maybe this is the reason that these women arouse in Snowman not even the faintest stirrings of lust. It was the thumbprints of human imperfection that used to move him, the flaws in the design, the lopsided smile, the wart next to the navel, the mole, the bruise. These were the places he'd single out, putting his mouth on them. Was it consolation he'd had in mind, kissing the wound to make it better? There was always an element of melancholy involved in sex. After his indiscriminate adolescence, he'd preferred sad women, delicate and breakable, women who'd been messed up and who needed him. He'd liked to comfort them, stroke them gently at first, reassure them.
make them happier, if only for a moment. Himself, too, of course. That was the payoff. A grateful woman would go the extra mile. But these new women are neither lopsided nor sad. They're placid, like animated statues. They leave him chilled. The women are carrying his weekly fish, grilled the way he's taught them, and wrapped in leaves. He can smell it. He's starting to drool. They bring the fish forward, put it on the ground in front of him. It will be a shore fish, a species too paltry and tasteless to have been coveted and sold and exterminated, or else a bottom feeder, pimply with toxins, but Snowman couldn't care less. He'll eat anything. "Here is your fish, O Snowman," says one of the men, the one called Abraham. Abraham as in Lincoln. It had amused Crake to name his Crakers after eminent historical figures. It had all seemed innocent enough at the time. "This is the one fish chosen for you tonight," says the woman holding it, the Empress Josephine, or else Madame Curie or Sojourner Truth. She's in the shade, so he can't tell which. "This is the fish Oryx gives you." Oh, good, thinks Snowman. Catch of the day. Every week, according to the phases of the moon, dark, first quarter, full, second quarter, the women stand in the tidal pools and call the unlucky fish by name. Only fish, nothing more specific. Then they point it out, and the men kill it with rocks and sticks. That way the unpleasantness is shared among them, and no single person is guilty of shedding the fish's blood. If things had gone as Craig wanted, there would be no more such killing, no more human predation. But he'd reckoned without Snowman and his beastly appetites. Snowman can't live on clover. The people would never eat a fish themselves, but they have to bring him one a week, because he's told them Craig has decreed it. They've accepted Snowman's monstrousness. They've known from the beginning he was a separate order of being, so they weren't surprised by this. Idiot, he thinks. I should have made it 3 a day. He unwraps the warm fish from its leaves, trying to keep his hands from trembling. He shouldn't get too carried away, but he always does. The people keep their distance and avert their eyes while he crams handfuls of fishiness into his mouth and sucks out the eyes and cheeks, groaning with pleasure. Perhaps it's like hearing a lion gorge itself at the zoo, back when there were zoos, back when there were lions. A rending and crunching, a horrible gobbling and gulping, and, like those long-gone zoo visitors, the Crakers can't help peeking. The spectacle of depravity is of interest even to them, it seems, purified by chlorophyll though they are. When Snowman has finished, he licks his fingers and wipes them on his sheet, and places the bones back in their leaf wrappings, ready to be returned to the sea. He's told them Oryx wants that. She needs the bones of her children so she can make other children out of them. They've accepted this without question, like everything he says about Oryx. In reality, it's one of his smarter ploys. No sense leaving the scraps around on land to attract rackhunks and wolvogs and pigoons and other scavengers. The people move closer, men and women both, gathering around, their green eyes luminescent in the semi-darkness, just like the rabbit. Same jellyfish gene. Sitting all together like this, they smell like a crate full of citrus fruit, an added feature on the part of Crake, who'd thought those chemicals would ward off mosquitoes. Maybe he was right, because all the mosquitoes for miles around appear to be biting Snowman. He resists the urge to swat. His fresh blood only excites them. He shifts to the left, so he's more in the smoke of the torches. Snowman, tell us, please, about the deeds of Crake. A story is what they want, in exchange for every slaughtered fish. Well, I owe them, Snowman thinks. God of bullshit, fail me not. What part would you like to hear tonight? He says. In the beginning, prompts a voice. They're fond of repetition. They learn things by heart. In the beginning, there was chaos, he says. Show us chaos, please, O Snowman. Show us a picture of chaos. They'd struggled with pictures at first. Flowers on beach trash lotion bottles, fruits on juice cans. Is it real? No, it is not real.
What is this not real? Not real can tell us about real, and so forth. But now they appear to have grasped the concept.
Yes, yes, a picture of chaos, they urge.
Snowman has known this request would be made. All the stories begin with chaos, and so he's ready for it. From behind his concrete slab cache, he brings out one of his finds, an orange plastic pail, faded to pink but otherwise undamaged. He tries not to imagine what has happened to the child who must once have owned it.
Bring some water, he says, holding out the pail.
There's a scramble around the ring of torches. Hands reach out. Feet scamper off into the darkness.
In the chaos, everything was mixed together, he says. There were too many people, and so the people were all mixed up with the dirt.
The pail comes back, sloshing, and is set down in the circle of light. He adds a handful of earth, stirs it with a stick.
There, he says. Chaos. You can't drink it. No.
A chorus.
You can't eat it.
No, you can't eat it.
Laughter.
You can't swim in it. You can't stand on it.
No, no!
They love this bit.
The people in the chaos were full of chaos themselves, and the chaos made them do bad things. They were killing other people all the time, and they were eating up all the children of Oryx against the wishes of Oryx and Crake. Every day they were eating them up. They were killing them, and eating them, and eating them. They ate them even when they weren't hungry.
Gasping here, widened eyes, it's always a dramatic moment. Such wickedness. He continues.
And Oryx had only one desire. She wanted the people to be happy, and to be at peace, and to stop eating up her children. But the people couldn't be happy, because of the chaos. And then Oryx said to Crake, "Let us get rid of the chaos." And so Crake took the chaos, and he poured it away.
Snowman demonstrates, sloshing the water off to the side, then turns the pail upside down.
There, empty. And this is how Crake did the great rearrangement and made the great emptiness. He cleared away the dirt. He cleared room
for his children, for the children of Crake.
Right. And for
the children of Oryx as well.
Right, says Snowman. Is there no end to his shameless inventions? He feels like crying.
Crake made the great emptiness, say the men. For us, say the women.
It's becoming a liturgy.
Oh, good, kind Crake.
Their adulation of Crake enrages Snowman, though this adulation has been his own doing.
The Crake they're praising is his fabrication, a fabrication not unmixed with spite.
Crake was against the notion of God, or of gods of any kind, and would surely be disgusted by the spectacle of his own gradual deification. If he were here. But he's not here, and it's galling for Snowman to listen to all this misplaced sucking up. Why don't they glorify Snowman instead? Good, kind Snowman, who deserves glorification more, much more, because who got them out? Who got them here? Who's been watching over them all this time? Well, sort of watching. It sure as hell wasn't Crake. Why can't Snowman revise the mythology? Thank me, not him. Lick my ego instead.
But for now, his bitterness must be swallowed.
Yes, he says. Good, kind Crake.
He twists his mouth into what he hopes is a gracious and benevolent smile. At first he'd improvised, but now they're demanding dogma. He would deviate from orthodoxy at his peril. He might not lose his life. These people aren't violent or given to bloodthirsty acts of retribution, or not so far, but he'd lose his audience. They'd turn their backs on him. They'd wander away. He is Crake's prophet now, whether he likes it or not, and the prophet of Oryx as well. That, or nothing. And he couldn't stand to be nothing, to know himself to be nothing. He needs to be listened to. He needs to be heard. He needs at least the illusion of being understood.
Oh, Snowman, tell us about when Crake was born.
says one of the women. This is a new request. He isn't ready for it, though he should have expected it. Children are of great interest to these women. Careful, he tells himself. Once he provides a mother and a birth scene and an infant Craik for them, they'll want the details. They'll want to know when Craik cut his first tooth and spoke his first word and ate his first root and other such banalities. Craik was never born, says Snowman. He came down out of the sky like thunder. Now go away, please. I'm tired. He'll add to this fable later. Maybe he'll endow Craik with horns and wings of fire and allow him a tail for good measure. Bottle. After the children of Craik have filed away, taking their torches with them, Snowman clambers up his tree and tries to sleep. All around him are noises, the slurping of the waves, insect chirpings and whirrings, bird whistles, amphibious croaks, the rustling of leaves. His ears deceive him. He thinks he can hear a jazz horn, and under that a rhythmic drumming, as if from a muffled nightclub. From somewhere farther along the shore comes a booming, bellowing sound. Now what? He can't think of any animal that makes such a noise. Perhaps it's a crocodile, escaped from a defunct Cuban handbag farm and working its way north along the shore. That would be bad news for the kids in swimming. He listens again, but the sound doesn't recur. There's a distant, peaceful murmur from the village. Human voices, if you can call them human. As long as they don't start singing. Their singing is unlike anything he ever heard in his vanished life. It's beyond the human level, or below it. As if crystals are singing, but not that either. More like ferns unscrolling, something old, carboniferous, but at the same time newborn, fragrant, verdant. It reduces him, forces too many unwanted emotions upon him. He feels excluded, as if from a party to which he will never be invited. All he'd have to do is step forward into the firelight, and there'd be a ring of suddenly blank faces turned towards him. Silence would fall, as in tragic plays of long ago when the doomed protagonist made an entrance, enveloped in his cloak of contagious bad news. On some non-conscious level, Snowman must serve as a reminder to these people, and not a pleasant one. He's what they may have been once. "I'm your past," he might intone. "I'm your ancestor, come from the land of the dead. Now I'm lost. I can't get back. I'm stranded here. I'm all alone. Let me in." "Oh, Snowman, how may we be of help to you?" The mild smiles, the polite surprise, the puzzled goodwill. "Forget it," he would say. "There's no way they can help him. Not really." There's a chilly breeze blowing. The sheet is damp. He shivers. If only this place had a thermostat. Maybe he could figure out some way of building a little fire up here in his tree. "Go to sleep," he orders himself, with no result. After a long session of tossing, turning, and scratching, he climbs back down to seek out the scotch bottle in his cache. There's enough starlight so he can get his bearings, more or less. He's made this trip many times in the past. For the first month and a half, after he was fairly sure it was safe to relax his vigilance, he got pissed out of his mind every night. This was not a wise or mature thing for him to have done, granted, but of what use are wisdom and maturity to him now? So every night had been party night, party of one. Or every night he'd had the makings, whenever he'd been able to locate another stash of alcohol in the abandoned, plebland buildings within reach. He'd scoured the nearby bars first, then the restaurants, then the houses and trailers. He'd done cough medicine, shaving lotion, rubbing alcohol. Out behind the tree, he's accumulated an impressive dump of empty bottles. Once in a while, he'd come across a stash of weed, and he'd done that too, though often enough it was moldy. Still, he might manage to get a buzz out of it. Or he might find some pills. No coke, or crack, or heroin. That would have been used up early, stuffed into veins and noses in one last burst of carpe diem. Anything for a vacation from reality, under the circumstances. There'd been empty Bliss Plus containers everywhere, all you'd need for a non-stop orgy. The revelers hadn't managed to get through all the booze, though often enough on his hunting and gathering trips.